This is side two of an interview between Dr. R. H. Roy and Lieutenant General Lane on December the 4th. Yeah, now to continue with the command and control, this is one thing that I was wondering about. Just from whom do you get your orders to go, shall we say? Now, this presumably would hold true of the brigade as well.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Exactly the same kind of command and control. I'm not that familiar with the brigade setup at that time on nuclear weapons. I was, I guess, more concerned and terribly more interested in my own problems.
Yeah.
And then, of course, once we got it, once I got authority at Air Division Headquarters, then I would then issue the operational instructions to the wings. But it's funny that, remember I said that the release of the weapons would come down a net, an American net, right to the wing, right to the base.
Yeah.
And the base commander would know that he had been, that the Americans had released nuclear weapons, because the man in charge, normally a major, U.S. Air Force major, would immediately inform the base commander that he had authority to release nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, I would be getting that same information at Air Div headquarters, mm-hmm. but it didn't come through my headquarters to the American. It came right down, shooting right down that single American communications network, and didn't go through my headquarters at all. But I would know from 4th ATAF, they were my senior headquarters, 4th ATAF, operational headquarters, they would inform me that authority to release had been granted, and they would then authorize the various strike missions or photo reconnaissance missions, whatever was required. Mm-hmm. And normally it was strike missions go in our exercises, and I would then issue the instruction to the wings to launch. Mm-hmm. And that was just literally the word we used, launch, and that was a ripple effect. We'd launch. I'm talking about the strike wings. They would just launch all of their airplanes. They all had their targets, and away they would go. And it was that was the way an exercise went.
Yeah.
We would bomb up. We would bomb up on authority from which would come down the line. But even when the airplanes were bombed up, they were still under American control. The weapons were still under American control, mm-hmm. and it wasn't. No airplane dare move. Couldn't move anywhere until. That release authority had come down for actually release of the weapons for operational purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Americans all over the airfield. Every aircraft had an American with it when that under those conditions, just to make sure that no one did make a move with a weapon on board. And so they were for the Americans, kind of twitchy moments when we were doing an exercise and we actually had the weapons on the airplane. Now, again, of course, they may have been defused. We had no way of knowing, because we didn't do any maintenance on those weapons, on those bombs. And for all we know, they may have been inactive, completely inactive.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it was always, the Americans were always just a trifle twitchy when those bombs were spread all over an airfield, and not under that, in the dump, where they could be under very tight security control.
Yeah.
Here they were scattered all over the place. Then once they were, that's why the exercise, you couldn't launch the airplanes in an exercise until those weapons were downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why there was always a moratorium, as we used to say, in the exercise. They just stopped the clock while all the bombs were downloaded and then put on their carriers and then restored to the special ammunition storage site. Then when they were all in, then the clock would start again in terms of the exercise, and you would pick up where you were. It didn't take very long to download and move them in. But you had to stop the exercise time-wise while that was going on. But the control of nuclear weapons was extremely tight, and it was all American. We just provided manpower to help with security, and of course bombing up and all that sort of thing. We did all that, but the actual control of the weapons was always American.
Well,
and
you talk about an American being with each plane. What rank did he have?
Sergeant.
I see.
Yeah, all sergeants. They had a couple of officers, but they were all sergeants, and they were all armament experts. Naturally, they were all armament experts.
It'd be Air Force sergeants.
Air Force. Yeah. and yeah. all armament experts, they were the ones who would do the maintenance on the weapons in their own maintenance shop.
I see.
Unless the weapon, and I don't know how often this happened, because, of course, they never did divulge any information. The weapons obviously had to be flown out for inspections every once in a while, and we would only know when we received word that an American transport airplane would be coming in, and there would be a transfer of weapons.
Yeah.
And that airplane would go right over to the dump, up the taxi strip, right to where the dump was, these special ammunition storage, and the Americans would do all the handling themselves. We wouldn't go near them, do anything. And they would offload replacement weapons and take other ones out, which I assume were going on a rotation basis for maintenance of the weapons, as opposed to checks and perhaps minor maintenance, which were done right in their workshops in the special ammunition storage site.
Yeah.
It was quite enough. Now, I was able to go through there. I was able to go in there. But I always had to ask the major for a time, because I was never allowed in there when any one of those weapons was, the covers were off or it had been stripped down.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I was only allowed in there when no maintenance work was going on.
Yeah.
And I would go through the shop and see how, and look at their setup and was there anything they needed, because we were responsible for looking after them. We had to provide them with all the administrative support in the way of construction engineering and painting and all the usual things.
Food and water, and
they had their own living quarters. They had quarters right in the special ammunition storage site, because a number always remained there, a correct number. And they had their rotation for duty purposes in that site. The others lived either in quarters on the base or in married quarters, because many of them were married, and either in married quarters or living on the economy, as the case may be.
Yeah.
But it was a terribly tight control, and I assume it still is, because nuclear weapons are still nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Yeah.
But coming back to the policy and government policy, the first, I suppose, real indication that of the final chop I got was when we were told that we were to begin work on the 104s in what they call the attack roll. The attack roll is the use of iron bombs, ordinary stores and bomb stores, plus the use of guns. Now, the 104 did not have any guns on it in the nuclear roll, in the strike roll. So we were told and were given the resources to in the air division, to modify a 104 and put a Gatling gun into the thing.
A Gatling gun?
Gatling, yes, and a hell of a thing, and it carries an awful wallop. So that thing we did, but it meant, of course, it took up all the bomb bay, as you can imagine, and everything like that. But we finally got it done, and we did the trials down at Detumamano, as a matter of fact, the firing trials, to make sure it worked. And it was just about that time, soon after that, that I left to come home. But already, the policy had been given that, oh yes, all right, there would be a retrofit of guns, and trouble was finding the damn weapons too, because there were not very many around, and it would had to be, I think we got some from the Germans, I think it was, but there was a terrible time in finding the weapons, because we weren't going to wait for a production order. We had to get them off the shelf from somewhere, and we did, but the program was agreed that was set up to begin a modification program.
Yeah.
Well, by that time, I left it. Soon after I left it, of course, the weapons were withdrawn. And I suppose my final pitch was that, again, was that I thought this was a terrible strategic error on the part of Canada, that we would get out of the nuclear role purely and simply because, it seemed that there were a few people who felt that it was a nasty business and not what the Canadian goody-goodies should be doing.
This would be, I think, following Trudeau's famous speech in April 60-something in Calgary, wasn't it?
That's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
I can't remember. See, of course, remembering that I was in the Air Division in Europe, and our news used to come over our landline that we used for operations, and we used to allow about 5 minutes a day for a rapid take and taping of news from Canada. And the only newspaper we never got any Canadian newspapers except what you received on your own personal basis.
Yeah.
The only newspaper we got were the Stars and the Stripes and the New York.
Times?
No, not the Times. What was the other one that was published in Europe, all over Europe? The New York. Herald, I guess it was. Herald? New York Herald? Anyway, it was it was a daily paper published, and you could buy those. But hell, the coverage of what was going on in Canada was...
Canada? Where's Canada?
Nil. Absolutely nil. It was one of our problems in Europe, was getting information from Canada. We couldn't even get Canadian books. We had to use the Stars and Stripes, the American retail organization, to sell magazines, books on our bases. And, of course, they were all American magazines, and they were all American books. And there was no... We couldn't get Canadian newspapers. We approached them, one company, now who the hell would it have been? I can't remember. It was in Toronto. We approached them and asked them if they would take... this was rather like Smith in Canada.
Yeah.
We asked them if they would take on a contract basis, to provide our magazine and bookshops on our bases. And they took a look at it and said, no way. There was no way they could make any money. As a matter of fact, they'd lose a fortune. And they said no. So we were stuck still with the, we were still stuck with the Stars and Stripes. But that business of Calgary, I've completely forgotten about, because I've heard about it, of course, in retrospect, much later. And the actual timing of the when the weapons were withdrawn from the air division, Reg, I'm sorry, I can't remember, because I had gone by that time.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was imminent, but I don't know when. I guess it was my successor who was there when they must have run in with all those transport airplanes and just loaded the vehicles on, the weapons on, and away they went. I think I would have cried if I'd been there, because during my whole of my service life, I have never felt as strongly about anything as I did about giving up of those nuclear weapons. I just couldn't. Here we were, and with a modern weapons system, almost you might say the state of the art. And to me, it was, from a political point of view, from Canada's position, I felt it was a bad decision. From a military point of view, where we were now having the latest in equipment, from a professional point of view, to me it was a disaster. And that was just an outright disaster. But there was no way I could stop it, and it went on and on, and I don't want to accuse anyone in Ottawa. The government obviously made the decision, and our headquarters in Ottawa, what kind of a fight they put up, I don't know. Maybe they didn't, but the decision was to get out of weapons, and we did. And
during the period when you were over there, I think you mentioned that periodically you would have the Minister of Defense.
That's right.
Pop over.
Who
would that be? Cadieux?
That would be Cadieux about that time, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and I know I never missed the opportunity in private to pound this. God, the money we spent on wine to grease the ways, so to speak. And as I recall it, Marcel Cadieux used to say, I can understand your position. I understand the military aspect of this. But nuclear weapons are very unpopular back home. And that was really all that I ever got from those discussions, that it was unpopular back home. And that was what used to bug me. I knew it was unpopular with the NDP, but I wondered who else it was unpopular with.
Mm-hmm.
I was almost certain that it wasn't unpopular with our veterans and so forth, people who had been in battle and perhaps had had the occasion to wish they had the latest weapons when they were fighting a fight and not throwing, as we were going to be doing now and will be doing, throwing iron bombs around when you're and receiving nuclear weapons on the other side. To me, the thing just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, it'll be unpopular with Mr. Trudeau, without a doubt.
Oh, yes. Now, politically. But I was really referring to the people of Canada, whether it was unpopular. There were those, as we have today, those people who are just against nuclear weapons, period. They would like to see them banned throughout the world. I don't know. I can't follow their logic. I would agree with them if it was followed by complete and utter disarmament across the board.
Yeah.
But to take one aspect of modern warfare and eliminate it, just one aspect, to me, is chipping away at an enormous block of granite. And I don't call that progress. War is war.
I suppose what one thinks of, I imagine most, shall we say, civilians or average person, and when they think of an atom bomb, they think of it squashing Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In other words, a war against the civilians, a great walloping, massive kill of civilians, rather than during the Second World War, where God knows enough civilians were killed, but at least the fighting tended to be on the front, rather than to the same extent.
To me, that's sort of an academic argument.
Because
the number of people are killed is the number of people are killed. War is war. However, that would happen. And, of course, after my tour at the Air Division, I thought I would go back to Ottawa. I really did. I had now had two commands. And I was very fortunate, because I had Air Transport Command. Air Transport, two field commands.
Yeah.
Air Transport, and the Air Division.
Yeah. But before you get out of Europe, there's another question I'd like to put to you. Again, it's command and control, I suppose. You said that you would get your orders from SACEUR, but wouldn't that come down
through the 4th ATAF?
4th Air...
Allied Tactical Air Force.
Yeah.
4th Allied Tactical Air Force. Commanded at that time by an American. By a 4-star American. In other words, a full general airman.
Mm-hmm.
And with Canadians on the staff. when I first went over there, the chief of staff, which of course was the real important operational position in the headquarters, was Canadian. But the Germans were growing much stronger. Mm-hmm. And once it got out, here's a typical example. Here's the sort of thing that began to happen immediately. The word got out that we were going to get out of nuclear weapons. When I left Europe, we no longer had the chief of staff position. A German was in that slot. And where we'd had a 2-star general, who was the real operational man, who ran the ops, and therefore had a great say in everything that was going to happen operationally, we lost that position, and it became a German before I left. And the reason was because our effectiveness was being reduced many, many, many fold, and therefore we had no right to ask for those important operational positions in the headquarters.
Who took over our role? German squadron?
I don't know. And no one would have told us. The security on that thing, on all that stuff, was so tight, Reggie wouldn't believe. It was the tightest security I have ever encountered, including a tour down in NORAD. The whole business of nuclear weapons and targeting was, even if I went to 4th ATAF, I would, even though I was a commander and I had a lot of targets, no way could I see what the other targets were that were being handled by the American Air Force in 4th ATAF or the Germans, and there were the three national elements in 4th ATAF. No way would they show me what the other targets were. So I just knew the part that we played, and I knew the importance of the targets because they were all given a number and a reference, and therefore we knew from that what the importance of those targets were.
Well, where were the British in this scheme? You mentioned the Americans.
They were in 2 ATAF.
The
2 ATAFs in Europe. 2 ATAF in the north. By the north, I mean the northern part of continental Europe.
Yeah.
Not Scandinavia. And then 4 ATAF in the southern part. And then that is in the German Franco front.
Yeah.
When you got down in the Mediterranean, then you had a different organization. You had the Italian Air Force and the Greek Air Force Turkish Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
When you got up into Scandinavia, you had Denmark and you had Norway.
Oh, yeah.
Within the central organization, it was the German Franco. I guess we can forget France. It was really the German front with the Iron Curtain. And behind that was England and then, of course, the Benelux countries. Now they also, of course, had nuclear weapons. But I have no idea how much, nor how many, nor to what extent. No way. There was no way of knowing. And only again, when you were at SACEUR in the nuclear planning shop, and I don't know how many other foreigners were in the nuclear planning shop at SHAPE, but I would doubt if there were any other than Americans. There may have been one or two others, but. Again, it was all the security, even within the military, was enormous.
What about those countries, though, right, that were manufacturing their own, although to what extent they were shall we say,
well,
on the
take
line.
Great Britain. See, Great Britain was making their own weapons,
yeah.
But I think they were making the strategic weapons. I don't think they were making tactical weapons. They were making weapons for their V bombers. They're sort of independent bomber force, if you will.
Yeah.
Although the RAF Bomber Command and SAC did meet for joint planning. It took them a long time to finally agree that it would be a good idea to get together and sort out a common bombing policy, because otherwise they might find themselves hitting the same target.
Right.
So, and they did. They did do that. So, now when it comes to the tactical weapons, I don't know enough about the, again, security. I don't know enough about the British situation and how far they went with the tactical weapons as opposed to the nuclear weapons, which was their primary requirement initially for their own V-bomber force. They wanted, Great Britain wanted to have a part to play in developing the policy of deterrence.
Mm-hmm.
A big say. And they felt that the only way they could do that was by building and developing their own nuclear weapons and having their own independent strike force away from SAC. And in that way, give them the leverage they wanted for counsel and a voice that could be listened to.
Yeah.
It was somewhat the same reason that France went the route
yeah.
that she did and developed her own nuclear weapons. She did it to gain that independence away from the Americans, not to feel that they had to blindly follow American military and perhaps even foreign policy, all tied into nuclear weapons.
But why would we necessarily and originally be under the American commander rather than, shall we say, the British? Why
would
we
have
to go?
Well, we have to go way back to the very beginning of the formation of NATO. Now, I'm going to have to do some real guessing here, because, again, I was not in Europe at that time, and I vaguely remember some of the stuff that was going on. But when we were planning for NATO, you know, at one time we even looked at providing a bomber force for NATO. That was one of the planning things, one of the options that was considered, but was thrown out. And it was resolved that we would provide a fighter force, and that was where the Sabres first came in. And it was agreed that we would put 300 over there, 12, four wings, and there would be 300 aircraft. Well, when it came to a question of where to put them, the problem was airfields, because we were now talking about airplanes that needed modern airfields. You know, not like World War One, where you could operate off the old steel strips, or literally off fields with strips laid down on them.
Yeah,
you had to have full-blown airfields. So the infrastructure program was initiated, where all the member countries of NATO poured X amount of dollars per annum into a pot, and the pot was then used and controlled basically by SAC, after with the approval of ministers, to develop all of these infrastructure requirements. And the airfields were one of the first major programs initiated. Because all here we were, and the Americans the same way, all coming over, but there were no airfields. So the airfields were built, started.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come to the part where I'm really not too sure of what happened. But we, I think with a certain amount of fighting, got the four airfields, Marville, Grootonquin, Zweibrücken, and Baden-Solingen. And Baden-Solingen, I think, had originally been allocated to the French, and I think we had a real hassle over that one. We needed a fourth airfield. And it was a grab bag, because those airfields were just unavailable. And here we committed ourselves to be in Europe by a certain date with 300 airplanes, and I think we got the first three wings, that is Marville, Grootonquin, and Zweibrücken without any difficulty, but I think the fourth was a real hiccup, and that happened to be Baden-Solingen. Well, I suppose if by that time we probably knew what the overall organization was going to be, in other words, the ATAF organization. Certainly at that time, there was Air Forces Central Europe. They even had another command level injected between the ATAFs and SACUR, which later was to be eliminated. There were several levels. ATAF, Allied Forces Central Europe, and then Commander-in-Chief Central Europe, and then SACUR. In other words, there are many levels here in the operational chain of command. It really was over-commanded, and it was corrected later. It was corrected while I was there. I think it was right that they locked out a couple of these levels. But We, of course, with the Sabres, we were using American equipment. And I suppose as a result of all the work that we had done with the Americans in that post-war era, getting together with them, and the PJBD operations that were going on, the talk of defense of North America, which PJBD was handling through the Military Cooperation Committee, we were developing a very, very close tie with the United States. And, of course, one of the big lessons that came out was, if we are going to have a new equipment, better it be American equipment, so that we can be tied to the American logistics chain. Mm-hmm. Because if we go out of overseas, we've got to rely on the Americans to provide us with the main logistics. Now, that was modified a little later, but at that time, we didn't see how we could possibly start a purely Canadian logistics support system. And when you just take one item, POL, petrol, oil, and lubricants, you can see the enormous problem of trying to set up your own independent line. You had to be tied into something. And then when it came to spare parts, here we were flying American equipment with American engines, although that was changed slightly, but we needed American ammunition. Where were we going to get all this stuff? We wasn't going to come down a ship. We weren't going to have a freighter leave every second Friday from Canada with what we needed and hope it would get there. We had to be tied into a shuriken. Yeah. So the natural desire was, when the ATAF organization was initiated, and I'm now assuming, I'm trying to remember, but assuming that once that organization was set up, Canada said, we want to be in the American ATAF, and it just happened that 4th ATAF was the American. In other words, they were in the southern part. Yeah. And we went and got all of our airfields within that same zone, so that we then would be, have, and we did tie into their logistics. And, of course, the great thing was that, and the Americans have, this has been my experience with the Americans all through my service career in any of my operational commands, if we ever got stuck for a piece or needed something, we'd fly to the nearest American base and say, can we borrow this particular piece? And without a doubt, some sergeant would say, sure, here, take it. And then the question would be, do you need a signature? You'd say, no, I'll write it off, or something like that. And we would get the bits that we needed when we were desperate sometimes. And they would cough up some bits and pieces that would keep us going. And sometimes they'd say, well, perhaps if you remember, would you return it? Let us have it, because it is on the books, and we're going to have an accounting for it one of these days. So will you return the bits? And I don't, whether they're serviceable or not, it doesn't make any difference, but return them so we've got something that we can show. And they were absolutely magnificent. And it's always that way. It was just great. I can't really recall a single occasion when we went to the Americans and said, we are in trouble. Well, we didn't do it every day of the week. Yeah. Only when we were desperate. I can't recall one occasion when we didn't, right through my career, when we were in deep trouble and we go to the Americans and say, boy, we are hurting. Can you help? And they'd all grin like hell and say, sure, what do you need? And away it would come.
Were we ever able to do anything for them?
Occasionally, yes, occasionally. And as always, again, here I can't say too much for the Americans. If you did even the smallest thing for them, it was almost as if you'd given them $100 million. It was, whether the Americans were so isolated and were taking so much abuse, justified or unjustified, both from the economy in Europe or in world political forums where they were constantly being attacked. And they always, I guess, felt that Canada was the one country that wasn't harping at them all the time. As a matter of fact, we were pulling together. And I'm convinced that as a result, there was almost a feeling right throughout the American forces that the Canadians were in the same boat with them, that they were pulling in the same oars, and therefore, if there was anything they could do at any time to help, boy, they would do it. And if you did the reverse for them and helped them out, as I say, it would go through the system just like you wouldn't believe that the Canadians had done that and therefore had helped them out on some particular thing. It worked out, I can't remember, let me give you a very good example, going back to the days of Air Transport Command. I signed with the commander of MATS an agreement whereby we would use each other's airlift for the priority and top priority of the airlifting of airplane or aircraft spare parts, including engines, to recover airplanes that had gone unserviceable along the routes somewhere and were sitting waiting for a spare part. And it worked out. I can remember one time when we had, I guess it was a Yukon that went sick for us, way out somewhere out in the bloody Pacific. And as a result of that agreement, instead of us having to send an airplane all the way out there, we were able to put an airplane on a Matz airplane. We got the airplane, the part down to San Francisco. We put on a Matz airplane, the next one that was leaving. And that damn thing arrived within a matter of hours to the sick airplane. We've also got some technicians on board, and they changed that engine out and put the sick engine back on the airplane and came home. Well, that saved us an incredible amount of money. What we did to help, we had airplanes going up to alert quite often. Now, Matz supported alert up northern tip of Greenland. They make the American base up there where the BMU site is. It's gone for the moment. Thule, yeah. Up in Greenland. Well, they were all Americans, like everybody else, were always short of airlift. Well, every time we had an airplane going up to Thule, and we did fairly frequently because we'd go on into alert, which was a Canadian base, and you'd always stage through Thule to get a last weather check. We would let the Americans know, we have an airplane going up, it's going up, and we've got X thousands of pounds available for freight. Oh, Jesus. Matz people would go nuts. And all we had to do was route that airplane down. It would always come and be an airplane normally from Ottawa or from Trenton. All we would do is just route it down into, I think their staging base was somewhere down in Maine, one of the big bases in Maine. So it was no distance for us to go and load up with the extra cargo and then fly up to Thule. Well, Jesus, to the Americans, that was just enormous.
Yeah.
And more goodwill was bought by that simple, we'd phone them and say, we have spare lift. Can you use it? And of course, they were always looking for spare lift.
Yeah.
Well, so that sort of thing was where it paid off, and it got known that we would help them whenever we could, and we would offer it. And the same way down at my airplane, or the airplane that the commander had in NORAD a little later, same thing. There'd be some part would go, whether it be an instrument or something, unserviceably, and the airplane was needed immediately or was needed for a trip. God, the American base there, they would cough up instruments and so forth right out of their holdings, no question, just waiting for a piece to come down from from Trenton or from Ottawa, as the case may be. Never. And no questions asked. That was a thing that used to get us. Never a question. Some sergeant would say, yeah, well, just give me an initial on this one, something like that, you know. No stacks of paper.
Yeah.
Well, But I think it's important because I do believe that that relationship still exists between our forces, certainly the air forces, and I hope it continues because it is a bloody economic way of running the ship. And if you can fall back on the enormous resources that the Americans have and they're willing to provide it with no nonsense, then that's the way to go.
I think there's a contrast to your story. There's one, I believe, that. Who was the Vader, the famous fighter? I don't know if I read it in the book or saw it in the film, where he, during the early part of the war, takes over command of a Canadian squadron where morale was very low and all that sort of thing. And he's inquiring why, and he finds out that the Canadians lack this and lack this and lack the other thing, so he stomps into the quartermaster store where there's a British chap in charge. And he's going by the old, peacetime basis that he wants a signature for everything. You know, there's lots of stuff in the stores behind, but he wants the whole thing, and the stuff is needed now.
Yes, yes.
And Vader uses, I believe, some choice language and gets that stuff out awfully damn quick.
Right.
And there is, this can make a fabulous difference.
Well, it does.
Especially if you're in the front line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to digress for a second because I may forget to get this in because it doesn't fit in anywhere. In this long song and dance, but something which has played an enormously important part in our relationship with the Americans, and again, it's primarily Air Force. It does. It has spilled over into the other services now, and thank God it has. But let's see. It would be about 58 or 59 when Johnny Plant and Doug Smith were up at great fishermen, professional fishermen, obviously fly fishermen, were up at Goose Bay doing a little trout fishing, and they heard about a river that was very good for salmon. So they managed to get hold of one of the old float planes out of Goose Bay, and they flew in. And sure enough, this river was an incredibly fine salmon river called Eagle River. Big river, hell of a big river.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they then talked the chief of that day into putting in what was referred to as a survival camp. And that senior people would go in to this survival camp for a few days and do some superb fishing.
Yeah, and survive.
And survive, that's right. Well, and it was, the survival was purely and simply a matter that you had to take everything in with you because there was nothing there. This is boondock country. There weren't even any Eskimos or Indians in that part of the land. You could leave everything out, just leave anything lying around out in that part of the Labrador because no one was going to come near the bloody thing. Well, this thing then, I don't know again who started it, but someone said, well, come on, this is too good to keep to ourselves. Why don't we invite the chief of the U.S. Air Force to come in and bring two or three people in to this camp, this survival camp, and let them enjoy fishing. Now, both Johnny Plant and Doug Smith knew that that particular chief at that time, I think it was Tommy White, but it may have been before him, great fly fisherman, superb fisherman, and of course would love this kind of thing. Well, that started it. So that every, and it was a camp. It was under canvas, sleeping on the ground in a sleeping bag. The meals were cooked over an open fire. It was that type of a setup. And weather was terribly important because this is now in latter part of July, early part of August is when the salmon run on the Eagle River. And the weather can clamp in very quickly up there. It can stay clampers for 2 and 3 days. And many, on occasion, they were surviving on the fish that they were catching. That was the only food they had in camp because the small airplane, they just brought in just a minimum of rations, relying on fishing to provide them with their main source of meat. But when they got hung up, their rations ran out very quickly, and they were literally living on fish. That did happen. So to a degree, it was survival. Well, the thing grew. And by the time I was invited, senior enough to be invited as one of the Canadians to go in, we're now up to about 1960, I suppose, the first time I went in, or 61. And it was now a question of the camp lasting about 9 days, and there were three camps of 3 days each. So that instead of just the chief and a few coming, it had now spread, and the chief and the commanders of all the commands were invited. Sakura was invited, and the chief of the RAF was invited, and perhaps one or two other RAF personnel. So it had kind of blossomed a wee bit in numbers. But the reason why was, of course, that it was such incredibly fine fishing. And it brought together all these people, these very senior people, under a condition where there was no nonsense. And one of the rules, the camp rules were printed in the and hung up in the camp, was there would be no shop talk.
Yeah.
That this is a relaxing fishing camp, and that's it. No more. Well, it was all very well to put that on a board, but that was the intent. But as you can imagine, after a whole day of fishing, and hard fishing, hours and hours and hours, because you started about 4:30 in the morning,
Ooh.
And you didn't finish until 9 o'clock at night. So you can imagine, by the time you'd had a drink before dinner, and with a little bit of glass of wine at dinner, everything would start to flow, and I mean flow. Everybody would be completely relaxed and terribly tired, physically fatigued, but mentally sharp, and the old battery going like crazy. Well, that camp, and it is still going on, and now, of course, it is broadened, now because of unification. The other services, now there are representatives from the other services come in, the chief of the naval, U.S. Navy, naval operations, CNOS, Army, and so forth, and it's been broadened in terms of, it's not just now all airmen the way it was in this one. But Again, I could relate stories of the value of that camp. Well, I said no business was talked. I'll just give you one of many. When we wanted to buy some 130s, we in that particular fiscal year, we knew we were going to have some money left over at the end of the year, some cash, and we weren't going to be able to spend it. Some of our programs had slipped rather badly, big programs, and so therefore the cash was available. But the money was in a boat where it was available for procurement of equipment. And therefore, if we want, the question was, or spend the money before the end of the fiscal year, or of course the money would lapse, and you'd go back to the next fiscal year, and everything would go before the House. Well, we approached Treasury Board and said, we have this money. Now, if we could arrange the procurement of these airplanes, which were in our program, but we hadn't actually budgeted for the money for that particular fiscal year, but they were in our long-term program, and Treasury said, yes, okay, providing you can pay for them this year. You're going to have to actually hand over the check in this fiscal year. Now we're running, I think this is now, where are we? It was fairly early on in the year, in about summertime anyway, when we were getting our first reading and we knew that we were going to have cash. Well, we went to the company, Lockheed, and they said, sorry, no bloody way, no way at all. And then we approached officially USAF headquarters in Washington. Deep regrets that the line, every tail number had been allocated and there was no way of sorting this out. And so we thought, oh, hell, damn, here's an opportunity to get four airplanes and not going to be able to do it. Well, gosh, at camp, the controller of the Air Force, who handles all the money in the USAF, became a very keen salmon fisherman. God, he, from nothing, he became a pro. And when tide brought fly tying gear into the camp and everything, just became bitten, absolutely smitten with this Atlantic salmon fishing. And this came up out in a boat one day about, what a shame. And he said, what do you mean you can't get any airplanes? And so the whole story was given to him, and he said, hell. He said, I'll fix that. And he said, I'll call you. And let's say it was the next day he was going back to Washington, and it was a Friday. He said, I'll call you on Monday. Well, by Jesus, if he didn't call Ottawa on Monday and say, it's all organized. I'll give you, you get on to so-and-so, and he'll give you the tail numbers of those airplanes. And what he had done is he had just simply gone to, I guess, I don't know where some of the airplanes were going to the USAF. You know? And I assumed to tactical command, and tactical command had been into Eagle River, the commander. And I assumed he just got on to the commander and said, look, we can help the Canadians a hell of a lot here. How badly do you need four tail numbers? Now, obviously, he got an answer, hell, I don't mind if I slip those four tail numbers. I don't need them. They're not desperate in terms of delivery. Sure, I'll wait. And so, with that agreement, he phoned, and by God, we then went back to Treasury Board and said, we've got guaranteed, well, to cut a long story short, we took delivery of those damn airplanes about February, I guess it was, or March, and the check was signed and the whole thing cleaned up before the end of March. So we got four airplanes when we would have had to wait perhaps another 2 years before we would have gotten those airplanes. Yeah. Well, that is, as I say, that's just one of many stories I could relate. Yeah. Oh, another one. when we did the 101, the 101 and the radar program, the radar station swap program. I think I've already related this. Canada agreed that we would take over the manning of certain number of radar stations in Canada, which were then manned by Americans, and offset the cost of procuring some 101 aircraft for our Air Defense Command. In other words, it was a swap deal.
Yeah.
Well, after a lot of negotiating and so forth on that, it got down to where there was a summing block, and I can't remember the exact detail of where we got hung up. But at the negotiating level, and this had been done through PJBD, in other words, it was done at a fairly high level. This was not done just at the colonel level or the group captain level where I was at that time. And it got to the point where it was just dead center, and there was no way of getting it off dead center. And I went to see Hugh Campbell, who was then the chief at that time, and I forget how it came up, and I said, I think the only way this is going to work, or he said it, but anyway, someone said, it looks as if the only way we're going to get this sorted out is for the chief to go to Washington and see, and I think at that time with, can't remember who, maybe it was Tommy White, who was the chief of the Air Force at that time. Well, he phoned, and of course everybody was on a first-name basis, which helped him enormously, and said, we've got this problem. I don't know if you heard about it. He said, yeah, I've heard about it. And he said, well, can we get together? And he said, when would you like to come down? And I think it was something like this, this afternoon. And the American chief said, fine, okay, I'll clear my books, and you can meet. Or it was the next morning. But it was done like that, over the phone. And we flew down and went into a meeting, and outside White's office, I guess it must have been Tommy White, there must have been at least a dozen briefers. And they had their easels and their charts and everything, you see. And one of the senior officers, I can't even remember his rank, whether he was a three-star or whether he was a two-star, came in with Hugh Campbell and I when we went in to shake hands and the usual pleasantries before getting down to business. And this boy came in as well, and then said, all right, now I have all the team ready. Shall I call them in? And I still remember Tommy White saying, hell no, we don't need all that. We're going to settle this ourselves. And Jesus, with that, they sat down, and we were out of the office in half an hour with a deal. With a deal. Settled to our satisfaction, and I assume to the Americans' satisfaction. And, God, when we came out, I shook Campbell's hand. I did, because it was such a big thing, and it went so easily. And I said, that was just masterful. He said, no, it wasn't. That was Eagle River. And there, that was the sort of impact.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that Eagle River meant, and I hope it continues, because there are many deals that get hung up in the bureaucracy, and there are times when it only takes a couple of the top heads to get together. As long as they know each other and like each other and trust each other, then bingo.
The Americans seem to have far more power on the decision making front in that respect than we have.
Absolutely.
They evidently fight for a pot of gold, but once they get their pot
of
gold,
that's right.
They can wheel and deal.
That's right. And they can also wheel and deal also within policy, too. Within broad policy, they can wheel and deal in a policy way, too, that our people wouldn't dream of doing.
Yeah.
As long as it fits within a very, very broad context.
Right.
Of the policy direction.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the only way they can operate. Hell, what's their budget right now? About $120 billion or something
around
like that for defense? Hell, you've got to delegate an incredible amount of authority in all respects if you're going to make that system work.
Yeah.
And the answer is very simple. If you blow it, you're fired.
Yeah.
And they do work that way. Coming back to Europe, I remember, again, it was at Eagle River.